Welcome into the Whole Hog Podcast. A new year, new us here in 2020. Seth Campbell joining you, and I'll be joined alongside Tom Murphy here in just 1 second. But 2020 is starting. That means a decade has ended, and it was a topsy-turvy decade for just Razorback athletics in general. So how we're going to do this and start off the decade on the right foot is we're going to look back. And how I thought, you know, the best way to do this would be to bring in each of our writers so they could talk about some of their favorite stories over the decade, relive the highs, and there might be a few lows mixed in there as well for the Razorback football team. And, you know, there's a few athletic events that may have been lows, but I figured that it would be good to get these guys in here. They can talk about some of their favorite stories that they've written over the past decade. We'll make sure that we put those links in the description of this podcast so you can go back and read and reminisce about the good times. And, you know, this is just going to be a fun podcast, and I'm joined alongside a fun guy right now in Tom Murphy.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And in preparing for this, I've did a lot of thinking about the last 10 years, which I was here the whole time, and some of the highs and lows. I consider myself a pretty positive guy in terms of, you know, how I view life and how I view things. And I'll certainly chronicle like the losing streaks and how bad they were this year. You have to chronicle those things and the stats that go along with them. But I try to look on the bright side of things usually. And so it's going to be fun to be going through this with you.
Well, we're going to need that bright side here in this podcast because we're going to start with the low side. And we're going to start with what has been, you know, a defining moment in Arkansas Razorback baseball history. We're going to go there, Razorback fans. 2018 College World Series was a fantastic year for the Razorbacks. They made it all the way to one out away, one foul ball away. But you were there for the entire thing. You said it was 15 days.
That's right. Yeah, because there were some rainouts and things got pushed back and ended up staying 15 nights.
So you were there for 15 days in Omaha. Let's start at the beginning. What was just the feeling of this team? I mean, even starting before Omaha, you know, there was a lot of expectations for this team, and they really embraced them.
They really did. It was a great start. And in preparing for this podcast overall, I thought, what were the biggest moments of the last 10 years? And in baseball, I thought Heston Kerstad knocking the Texas first baseman, his butt into the dirt,
right?
Like, that's my bag, was one of those. And it happened in Omaha, and it was a badass moment, and it kind of defined that game. There was a huge rain was like a theme there.
Oh my goodness.
That game was delayed for, I want to say, more than 2 hours, close to 3 hours it was delayed. And Arkansas scored a little bit before that, but they really blew up because the delay happened in the middle of an inning, and they blew up the rest of that inning, and I think the final was 11-5 or something like that. But they really got the bats going, and I guess Blaine Knight got a win in that game.
I believe so. If I remember correctly, he did get the win.
But now, he just pitched the minimum. Like Maybe the delay happened in the fifth inning or something.
Right. And that was something – that was a theme with this team. When Blaine Knight was on the mound, they were indeed unbeatable. They only lost, I think, one game when he started, and that loss didn't go to Blaine.
Well, yeah, it was a Mississippi State game. Mm-hmm. They lost. I think there might have been one other, but yes – He did not lose any, and he would go on to win his 14th while they were in Omaha. But the way they started, beating Texas Tech, and I think there was a delay before that game.
There was.
And then they beat Florida with Isaiah Campbell. And he's a guy who had such an up-and-down year, but the way they were playing at that time, for Campbell to go out and beat the defending College World Series champion in such a dominant program – kind of showed you where they were going. And it's like you said, I mean, ultimately it was a downer by the way the game ended, the second game ended, but you're right, a great team, and the karma all seemed to be going in their direction too until the pop foul.
You could tell. I was also there for this College World Series run, and you could tell from Van Horn and his teams that they were focused in this year. They got to the 2-0, they beat Texas, and they beat Texas Tech, and you could even tell in their post-game interviews that they're like, hey, this isn't done. Van Horn has told us that he's been here before back in 2012 with South Carolina, and they ended up losing the next two games. They're like, we're not done. We need to win one more to get the championship game, and then they're like, and then we have some more unfinished business to do. You could tell that this team, their ultimate goal was to win that national title, and they were oh so close to doing that.
What a great combination of players, too. Veterans like Carson Shaddy and Luke Bonfield and Blaine Knight. Casey Murphy, just, you know, some older guys. And then the fresh, you know, Casey Martin, Kerstad were such vibrant players for them. So it was a really good blend. And I think when the full tale of is told of Arkansas baseball, this will be one of the funnest and one of the most remembered teams because of that. And won the first game 4-1 over Oregon State with Blaine Knight. He went 14-0, and Cronin saved his 14th game. So both of these are school records. 14 wins, 14-0 record. Cronin saves his 14th game. In game two, I've thought about this quite a lot. I mean, Van Horn had a pretty quick hook with Casey Murphy in that game. He did not want him to face the Larnick and Rutschman duo at the top of the order any more times than he had to. And I think if he went back and reflected, maybe if you just try to get another inning or maybe two innings out of him, then you don't have to use Cronin for as long. And he was running on fumes at that point. And we're talking about the end of game two. They had the lead, and then it all kind of fell apart for him.
Right. I remember Cronin coming in to throw his warm-up pitches, and he threw an off-speed pitch, and he bounced it right in front of the plate. And just making a mental note to myself of, that's the off-speed, he bounced it. How many of those is he going to actually throw in this outing? And he didn't throw very many, if any. I can't remember back to that far right now, but that was Cronin that year, was mainly fastball, 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 and it just eventually caught up to him against Oregon State.
It did. And then the one inning, Caden Grenier at bat, the pop foul. I mean, I think the play, and I've talked about this on radio appearances over the last couple of years, but I think the play kind of funneled into some personalities. Carson Shaddy, go-getter, you know, forceful personality. He had a chance at the ball, so he called for it. Whereas the right fielder, Eric Cole, a little bit more of a laid-back dude, if he's calling for it, okay, that's his ball. But what you want is you want the right fielder to come in forcefully, and because he had the best angle, and kind of overrule. And I think that might have been ultimately the best play. It just didn't happen that way. And Jared Gates at first said he could have caught it too. So it was in a bad triangle.
It was a bad triangle indeed. And the College World Series is unique for people that cover college sports in the fact of they will allow the locker rooms to be open. Locker rooms are open, so after the game, you can go in there and talk to anybody that you want that is on the team. They bring two or three up to the podium, and those questions are documented for everybody, but you can go into the locker room and interview whoever you want. Take us inside that locker room after game two, Tom.
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, I appreciate all the Razorbacks for talking. Some guys might have shut it down. Cronin had the 1,000-yard stare, or do they call it 1,000-mile stare?
Right.
Because of what had just happened, but he talked. And Carson Shaddy talked. They all talked. Jared Gates said he could have gotten the ball, Eric Cole. But you're so down. There was another game left. But I think all of us in that locker room who were interviewing him, it felt that they would not come out the next day and, you know, be the same team. I will always contend there was a rainout the day before the day it was supposed to start. There was
yes.
a rainout, and
yes.
I really feel their pitching was to the point that you go Knight, Murphy, Campbell, and you close them out. You might not even need game three. But Oregon State caught a huge break because
yes.
they had used their pitching a lot more.
They lost their very first game in Omaha, so Oregon State had to come through the loser's bracket. I will never forget that. That Monday game, they decided to push it back to where instead of it was a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday,
That's right.
was a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And an extra day just can breathe life into a bullpen and into a staff that needed that day so bad.
They really did, and they started with game two. And their lefty relievers, I think, were kind of the unsung heroes behind the hitters. I mean, because Rutschman had a great series. But, you know, it hurts. But you know what? It was a great Arkansas team, and I had a great time being there.
And I think this team set the table for a lot of teams to come. You've seen in the recruiting rankings now for Arkansas baseball that they are consistently top five. You know, they got – Van Horn was doing a lot before that with not as much talent according to the rankings. So it is going to be really interesting to see when he is getting these top five classes, what really comes – after this. And that team, while they may not win the national title, may not get the rings or anything like that, they might have set the table for some teams in the future to do that.
Agree. He's a great recruiter. He's got a great staff right now, great talent on hand right now as well. And with the upcoming facility addition, the renovations. The Razorbacks are positioned very well.
All right. Enough of the downer stuff, Tom. There was some good things that happened in this decade, and I think let's start with the beginning of the decade in Razorback football, and it really started off with a bang in the 2010s. Bobby Petrino was here. He was in his third year in the 2010s, and he really got this football program rolling, including a Sugar Bowl berth, and really the game that sent Arkansas to that Sugar Bowl and is one of the more memorable games of the decade is the Arkansas versus LSU at War Memorial. The play that always sticks out to me is the Kobe Hamilton right before halftime, the two LSU players colliding with each other. Go into depth about what that game meant to this team.
It was massive. The Sugar Bowl rep was there. Everybody kind of had that feel. If Arkansas beats LSU, they're in the BCS. And likewise, LSU would have been too in a bowl game in New Orleans. But the Razorbacks were playing with a great edge that year. They had just enough defense. It was Mallett's second year, plenty of offense. And a few things stand out to me. Right before that play, was it 6 or 8 seconds left in the half? One of the two. Steve Beuerlein goes, well, Arkansas will kneel on the ball. Well, he didn't know Arkansas.
Right.
And I like Steve Beuerlein, by the way. It's just that he didn't know him. And they throw that deep pass. And, yes, Carnell Hatcher and another LSU defensive back collided, which helped Kobe there. But he's a great open field runner. And let's not forget, Jarius Wright was running all the way down the field and screened off Patrick Peterson for about 10 yards. That was the final, the final bit that helped Kobe Hamilton get in the end zone. And yes, that might be the play of the decade for Razorback football. Fantastic play. There's still a lot that happened in the second half as well that led to the 31-23 final. One thing I remember is Bobby Petrino Jr. was on the sideline. We go down with 5 minutes left in a game. So I was down there. And Niall Davis ran a ball. Arkansas was trying to run the clock out. And LSU's might be out of timeouts at this point, a minute something left. And Niall Davis ran the ball and stayed down on the ground. He got dinged up. And Steve Shaw, who's now supervisor of officials, was the white cap for that game. At some point, you have to stop the clock because a player is hurt. Well, the clock doesn't resume. So had Niall popped up, the clock would have kept running. Mm-hmm. They had to stop the clock. Well, Bobby Petrino Jr. is over there screaming at the officials about this.
I'm sure using colorful language with the last name Petrino.
It was forceful. And some back judge, I don't know if he knew who he was or not, but he said, if you guys don't shut this guy up, he's going to be thrown out of the game. And so that was kind of the craziness. And, Arkansas ended up having to punt, and they pinned them deep, and I think they got a fumble. I think Jake Beckett caused a fumble, and Jerry Franklin might have recovered that. That closed out the game, but it was a fantastic performance by the Razorbacks.
And you said the Sugar Bowl rep was on site. I remember reading in the story that we're going to link in the description below so you can reminisce here with us. You said that the bowl rep was there, and he said after that game that, and if Auburn wins, Arkansas is going to the BCS. They're going to the Sugar Bowl. And that was the first time that happened for Razorbacks.
Yeah, it was the only time Arkansas ever played in the BCS. Another play from that game, there was a 4th and 3, and I want to say from the 39-yard line. And there was a timeout called because you don't know, it's a super long field goal. What are you going to do? It might have been a little closer than 39. But Arkansas came out and ran a beautiful play. It was a little stop-and-go route. Joe Adams versus the Honey Badger. And he got the Honey Badger to bite, release behind him, and Mallett feathered the pass in perfectly for a 30-something-yard touchdown. That was a really big play in that game.
Yeah, Bobby Petrino's teams weren't afraid to go for it, and, they weren't going to throw those short passes either. And one that comes to mind is the Miracle on Markham 2. That wasn't in this decade, but the second one with Casey Dick to London Crawford, is that correct?
That's right.
Yep. So that Bobby Petrino team, they ended up going to the Sugar Bowl, and as it seems like for most Razorback fans, the Sugar Bowl didn't turn out so well, but that was a memorable season, and it even set up next season with Tyler Wilson at the helm and the Razorbacks winning 11 games, capping that off with a Cotton Bowl victory. There is one more game, though, that happened, and you said that Kobe Hamilton play may be the most memorable play from this decade, but there are some Razorback fans that might disagree with you, and we have to talk about that game, and that is the Arkansas-Ole Miss game in 2015 in the Hunter Henry Heat.
Yeah, a phenomenal game. The first thing that comes to mind for me in that game was that the scoring was right on, like it was 7-7, 14-14, you know, and they were trading the ties. I mean, it might have been 10-10 and then 17-17, but they never got separated by more than a touchdown, and it just kept on that way. And Brandon Allen was racking up stats, and Chad Kelly was racking up stats, and it was a fun game to just watch. And I remember at the very end of regulation, I want to say Arkansas got the ball last and threw a deep pass to Dominic Reed, and he went up. He was way up to make that catch, and it was in fringe field goal range. And I want to say, did that field goal get blocked?
Yes, or
it was missed.
And I was able to read your story that we're going to link as well, and it was blocked. It was in the I can't remember what range it was in, but it was blocked. And Bielema said after the game that he felt that the kicker just tried to hit it too hard, and it was too low.
Yeah, well, and that would have been the game winner. But if that had happened, then we wouldn't have gotten a beautiful overtime scenario.
Yeah, 4th and 25, and there's so many things that are just so intriguing about that play. The fact that, you know, they throw the ball short to Henry in the first place. Like, a lot of quarterbacks wouldn't even want to risk it throwing it behind line of scrimmage, because if he catches it, what happens? Then Henry having the wherewithal to just throw it backwards and see what happens. The ball landing in Collins' hands. And in the article, you go through just the multiple things that I'm talking about that had to happen for this to count. And then the craziest thing of all is the guy with the ball, Alex Collins, thought that they had to have a touchdown and fumbled it. You could have had this incredible play. Alex Collins come out at the end, fumble it, and it would have been for nothing. And instead of going down in Razorback lore, it would have been Razorback gore.
I really enjoyed that post game. Brett was in a fine mood. That was the game where he said, I'm going to go hop on my wife.
Yes.
And here's something. This really stands out to me. There are photo shots of when Henry catches the pass. Well, an Ole Miss defender closes very quickly at his legs. And as he's spinning around, it looks like he's going down. Hugh Freeze is on the sideline with his hands in the air in the victory salute.
Right.
And a couple of other guys are doing it too. That's how close the game was to being over. And they did a ESPN Sports Science, what I wrote a story on later, about all the angles and trajectories and the perfect bounce. Footballs don't bounce often like that ball off of Dan Skipper's fingertip down to the ground, bounced up perfectly for Alex Collins to catch in stride. And have a bit of a cordon over there. I want to say that Jeremy Sprinkle, mm-hmm. I want to say a tackle might have been out there, and Drew Morgan was out there. And for him to get the needed yardage, and he did some kind of stutter step move too that helped get the first down distance. Alex Collins and Hunter Henry both admitted after the game they thought they had to score a touchdown on the play. Crazy. Dominic Reed was the man on the spot. He recovered the fumble. He caught 2 touchdowns in that game, and Drew Morgan caught 3 touchdowns in that game, including one to come.
That was an incredible game, as you said, the one to come. And then to cap it all off, Arkansas decides to go for 2, which was probably a good decision. They couldn't stop Ole Miss all game long. Ole Miss couldn't stop them, so they're like, we're going to end it here. And Brandon Allen gets stopped behind the line of scrimmage. I was a freshman in college, and I was watching this in a dorm room, and I distinctly remember there were multiple people in our hall that I guess were watching the game or something, because I was in the room with about 5 other people in a cramped dorm room, and we're watching it, and Allen gets taken down, and you can hear from somebody down the hall going, no! Like, basically, this entire thing was all for naught, and then, like, just the distraughtness of everybody that was in the room with me. And then all of a sudden there was a flag on the play, and you go, there's a flag. There's a flag. And Arkansas season was saved once again.
Marquise Haynes was the poor guy who got to Allen. He had him corralled, man. It was like a tiger with a, antelope right there. There was nothing he could do, but he grabbed his face mask. By the way, my positioning on the Henry heave was the Arkansas sideline. I was on about the 12 or 13 yard line standing there, and I saw Allen's pass go to the other side of the field, and I thought, well, that's it. I knew it wasn't long enough. And the next thing I know, Alex Collins is basically running right at me. And I thought, how did he get the ball? How did that happen? I had to watch replays later. Uh-huh. And he comes running right in front of me. And the fumble occurred just 5 yards from me, and I come walking up with a quizzical look on my face like, what just happened? Which I'm sure a lot of Ole Miss people did too. The two-point conversion, had him, got the extra try, and it was a little quarterback keeper off the right side, and he just got in, and he got hammered too. And you remember, he's down on the turf for 30 seconds or so, people wondering, did he get knocked out? What's going on? Mm-hmm. It was a crazy, crazy moment.
Yeah, and as you said, Bielema was in rarefied form, saying that he hopped on his wife instead of hopping on the plane in the post game, and that Arkansas loss prevented Ole Miss from going to Atlanta. Is there three or four teams that haven't been to Atlanta in the SEC for the SEC championship game?
Well, yeah, Vanderbilt still hasn't gone in Kentucky.
In Ole Miss. So they're one of three teams, and that loss right there prevented Ole Miss from going.
And A&M now, too.
Yes, but that is correct.
You're right, and Ole Miss fans just lament that had the rest of the season played out like it did, they would have gone. And it's crushed them. And I don't know. I mean, the Hugh Freeze regime wound up kind of ending in ignominy. Is that the word for it? It was a fun game, and I'm glad I was there to cover that one.
Well, that is all the time that we're going to have here on the Whole Hog Podcast for Tom Murphy. Stay with us. We were going to give you some more Whole Hog content here. Basketball season is upon us, so we will get you some basketball information. The Hogs keep on rolling with Muscle Men. But, Tom, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast. Great to reminisce.
It was fantastic. And a lot of that stuff just kind of imprinted in my brain now. I mean, just rattle it right off. And those were fun days.
As we said, you can read all of Tom's articles. The links will be in the description. If you want to reminisce with us, go back, you know, see what was said right after the games and in the days following those games. We will link all of those here on our website, wholehogsports.com, and links will be in the description as well. Welcome into the Whole Hog Podcast. Seth Campbell joined alongside Nick Suss. He's an Ole Miss writer for the Clarion Ledger. And Nick, Ole Miss coming off of a 47-57 loss this week to Texas A&M to begin conference play. What happened to the Rebels that they only scored 47 points down in Aggieville?
Well, I mean, first give Texas A&M a little bit of credit. That's a really good defense they have there. But the bigger thing is Ole Miss can't really shoot right now, and it's been a bit of a season-long issue where Brian Tyree still looks good, and anyone who followed college basketball last year remembers how good of a shooter Brian Tyree is, and he scored, I think, 26 of those 47 points, and I mean, he was doing his part, but Ole Miss really hasn't been able to find consistency offensively now that Terrence Davis is in the NBA, because I think his presence just pulled so much defensive attention away from Tyree last year, and SEC teams really couldn't cover both of them. Now, Devontae Shuler's not shooting the way he did last year. I think the new three-point line is affecting him. KJ Buffin's been a pretty good offensive option when he's been on the court, but he hasn't been able to stay out of foul trouble this year. Blake Henson's spotty at best. He's a good deep shooter, but he really hasn't found a presence down low, nor has Hadeem C, the JUCO center that they signed, who was supposed to really shore up the middle of this offense. And I mean, you just go down the line, this is a very inconsistent offense that is pretty easy to figure out how to stop. You either take away every option and don't let Tyree beat you, or you take away Tyree and hope that these other guys continue to miss shots. And I mean, that's the easiest way to put it, is this team's really not making shots. They don't have any bench options. KJ Buffin can't stay out of foul trouble. And you put those three things together and you have a team that has no easy fix right now.
You mentioned, you know, that this team is struggling to make shots. They returned four starters from last year's team. Is it that they are just missing that one guy?
I think they're just missing that one guy, and I also think they're just missing. I don't think they have bad looks. I just don't think the shots are falling, and I can't really explain why. But yeah, Terrence Davis was the team's leading rebounder last year, and I believe he led the team in assists last year. He was the linchpin of this team, and if you look at the advanced metrics, he's with the Toronto Raptors right now, and there's an argument to be made that he's been the most efficient rookie in the NBA this year. He really was the straw that stirred the drink, if you want to use that cliche, for this team last year. But I also think this is just a team that there was a lot of issue at the beginning of the year with sharing the ball. They were kind of stuck, glued to the floor. Now they've started passing, and they're one of the better passing teams in the SEC by assist to turnover ratio and by pure assists and all of that stuff. They're getting the ball where it needs to be, but they don't have the framework and the infrastructure to take the high percentage shots you'd want to right now, just because this isn't a team built around its bigs. So it's going to be very spotty, built around shooting deep, or whether it's built around getting to the free throw line, which is something they didn't really do against Texas A&M. You put all that together and it's a team that's just struggling to find an offensive identity. And that's what Kermit Davis has said, that his teams have two things in common. They play defense and they pass the ball. And that's true of this team this year, finally, but they're passing, but it's not really leading to much.
Ole Miss at 9-5 on the year this year, Nick, and we're talking to Nick Suss, Ole Miss writer for the Clarion Ledger. And, you know, they were an 8 seed in the NCAA tournament last year. And then coming into this year, it was, like I said, with the four starters returning, that, you know, they were kind of on the edge. Some people thought they might be in the tournament. They wouldn't be in the tournament. What do you see that this Ole Miss team needs to do the rest of the year in conference play to earn a berth in the NCAA tournament?
Yeah, I wrote about this week, and I think there are really four keys this team needs to capitalize on, and I've touched on a few of them already. But number one, this team has been brutally bad in the 5 minutes between the 15 mark and the 10 mark in the first half. So that point when teams make their first round of substitutions, brutal. They've been so bad in there, and it's because the bench just hasn't been producing very much, and they need to find a reliable sixth and seventh man. And I think some of that will come when Luis Rodriguez, who started the first four or five games of the year, comes back from injury. He's been dealing with a foot thing, and he's supposed to be back by February, but he will help. But beyond that, they need more than just that for the offense to be reliable when other teams make substitutions, so that they're not gassed throughout the first half. They need to keep KJ Buffin out of foul trouble. He's had two or more fouls in the first half six times already this year. That's pretty unacceptable for a guy that is your leading rebounder and funnels your front court offense. They're going to need Devontae Shuler to limit his turnovers, which he's done a really good job of the last six or seven games. But beyond that, I mean, this is a team that I believe it's median offensive output before last night, when Devontae had a 2.5 or better assist to turnover, was 82 points a game. And when it was worse than 2.5, it was 70 points a game. That's a pretty simple formula right there. And then beyond that, as I've mentioned, you just need to make your first halves a lot better, because I mean, they got down, I think, 19 against Penn State in the first half, came back to win that one. They were down as much as 15 in the first half against Memphis, came back to lose by one. You can't sustain that second half comeback mentality. They need to get out ahead of themselves and actually compete better earlier in order for some of these SEC games to matter.
Well, looking ahead now specifically to this Arkansas versus Ole Miss matchup on Saturday, Nick, what do you see, you know, can work in Ole Miss's favor against Arkansas, if you've even been able to watch any of the Arkansas games? And then what do you see will not work for in Ole Miss's favor against the Razorbacks?
Yeah, I mean, Arkansas's playing better basketball right now than Ole Miss, and that's unavoidable. I think that one thing that could work in Ole Miss's favor is you really just don't know which Ole Miss offense is going to show up. And if the streaky offense that is making shots shows up, and if they're able to play in transition like they want to, and if they can mix the 1-3-1 and the 2-3 and the man defense that they do so well against Arkansas, I think that a team with a first-year coach could end up being confused just by Ole Miss's mixing defenses and speed on the perimeter and all that stuff. And that could be an asset. But if this becomes a half-court game and Arkansas is able to use its bigs, which from my vantage point are a little bit more developed than Ole Miss's have been so far, if it's a slow game, I just don't see how Ole Miss keeps up, because Ole Miss isn't really equipped to win slow games right now. Texas A&M proved that, and Wichita State proved that. And I mean, if you guys want to see an absolute massacre, look at the box score from the Oklahoma State game back in Brooklyn in November. I think that one was like 75-37 or something. When teams make Ole Miss play the style of basketball that they want to, and Ole Miss doesn't get to dictate the pace of the game, things get ugly quick.
Yeah, before I let you go, you mentioned that Oklahoma State Ole Miss game that you said was just a massacre. When you're looking through the schedule for Ole Miss, that one just stands out. What happened in Brooklyn to this Ole Miss team to lose 37-78 to Oklahoma State?
You want the shortest answer possible? They shot 1-for-20 from 3-point line.
Oh my.
Yeah, they were 1-for-20 from deep. I mean, they were trying to come back, and they were coming off of back-to-back really emotional games, because the Memphis game was 2 games ago and the Penn State game was the game before. And this was a team that Luis Rodriguez had just gotten hurt 2 days earlier, so they were still trying to figure out who they were. And they relied heavily on a JUCO kid named Bryce Williams, who played really well against Penn State, who just hasn't shown up again since. And I don't know if that gamble really worked out. And it's just, they played horribly. The defense didn't really have an answer. I think they got bullied down low by Oklahoma State's big. If I'm remembering right, he had 6 or 7 blocks, and the day before, Penn State's big had 8 or 9 blocks. But yeah, they couldn't shoot and they couldn't defend, and it turned ugly fast.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for joining us here on the Whole Hog Podcast, bringing great information for all of our listeners.
Happy to do it. Yeah.
All right. Well, that was Nick Suss, Ole Miss writer for the Clarion Ledger. Make sure that you can check out all his stuff online on the Clarion Ledger website. On today's Whole Hog Podcast, we will give you an excerpt from the Basketball Podcast of Mid-America. The Basketball Podcast of Mid-America is a podcast that Scotty Bordelon and myself, Seth Campbell, put together to give you the latest breakdown on all things Arkansas Razorback basketball. So if you like it, it appears right here on this station. So if you're subscribed to Whole Hog Radio, then you'll be able to listen to it. It'll come right into your inbox, and wherever you're listening to this podcast on, you can find it. But this is just an excerpt. If you want to listen to the entire conversation, just go to the Basketball Podcast of Mid-America, click on it, and you can listen to the entire conversation between Scotty and I. I have issue with the last second call. I think I understand where Musselman's coming from, because you're down by two, which, you know, as I said, the Witt foul changes the entire complexion of this game. You're down by two, you got to go the length of the court in 8 seconds, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so I understand where Musselman's coming from. I'm sure in his mind, I'm not even going to try and get into the mind of Musselman, but from an outside perspective, it seems like, all right, we lost Mason Jones. Adriel Bailey's got 4 fouls. Chaney has a technical, and he hasn't played the entire second half. I have about 5 guys, the 5 guys that are on the court that can play, maybe 6, you know, if I want to. I don't think I want this game to go an extra 5 minutes on the road. So I'm going to try and end this game with a 3. I get that, because I think that you're...
I think that's why you put the ball in Isaiah's hands.
The possibility of you winning this game if it goes into overtime is slim, but there's got to be some kind of better play call than what they did with Isaiah walking it up the court. I mean, okay, it was like a slight jog that he's going up the court with. Get up the court and do something. You have 8 seconds in this game. Even... A play that's become pretty popular ever since it was run in the national title game, the North Carolina. Well,
or
not
the Kansas Memphis.
Well, not the Kansas Memphis one. This was the North Carolina. Is it Villanova game where North Carolina hit the last shot, and then the guy, you get it into a point guard, he dribbles it up the court as fast as he can, takes on two defenders, and just drops it back.
To the trailer. Yeah.
I mean, I would rather have that shot with Isaiah Joe, you know, even a few steps behind the 3-point line, taking an open shot rather than him trying to go off the dribble. He hit one off the dribble three in this game, which is one of his 2 3-pointers. But Isaiah Joe is just not that great off of the dribble. So I would rather have set up a different play for him than just having Joe semi-dribble it up the floor and shoot. Like, that was easy to defend if you're LSU. You couldn't ask for anything better because you know that more than likely Joe's going to be the shooter here. And if you don't have that foul and wit, yeah, you can drive. And then that changes the entire complexion of the game too, because like you said, you can maybe have Jalen Harris, or you could set up something for Jimmy Witt like Musselman did towards the end of the game.
Yeah, with right under a minute left. He Isaiah brings the ball up the floor. Mason comes off a stagger screen on the right side of the floor, get it to him, kick it to him on the right wing. He attacks off the bounce left, gets into the middle of the paint, and then Jimmy Witt comes from the left short corner. It cuts to the free throw line, and Mason just kind of turns and pitches to Jimmy, and he knocks down a jumper.
Beautiful play call. Just absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. I kind of wish they would have gone to something like that, or like I said earlier, put the ball in Jalen's hands and just like create a little bit of havoc and see if LSU wouldn't overhelp and overreact. You know, I think we've talked about it before on this podcast, like in late in games, and it may have been after the Kentucky game or after the Northern Kentucky game when Adriano helped a little bit too much.
The Western Kentucky?
The Northern Kentucky game.
Oh, the Northern,
when
yes.
Northern
yes,
Kentucky
is.
Had a chance to, I think, take a lead with a corner,
wide open corner three. Yep, you're right.
Adriano helped too much. So maybe you dive into that a little bit and maybe see if you can't get a defensive overreaction, leave somebody open for a score. Or like you said, just the play where they got Jimmy an open jumper from the free throw line. He was 8 of 12 on those. And you need 2 points to keep the game moving. I don't know. Maybe that's what I would have gone with, but I don't by any means want to, you know, second guess what Eric Musselman was doing, because he drew up, he dialed up 2 really good plays in the last minute that got Arkansas some big buckets.
Yeah, he dialed up those plays, and I for sure it didn't help that Mason Jones was out of the game. That's a right. weapon that LSU doesn't have to worry about on the defensive end, and that's a weapon that Arkansas can't use. Mason is pretty good at making his own shot. And towards the end of the game, he can step back and make shots. He showed that in this game. He's shown it all throughout this season. Isaiah has been more of a guy coming off of a screen and not off of the dribble.
And the one score that Isaiah had in the last minute when he got the and one to give Arkansas the lead, I think, what was it with 30? Yeah, it was around 35 seconds yeah. left, I think. And Eric Musselman drew up a fantastic play where the ball high ball screen with Adriano. Isaiah turned the ball screen down, drove left, and then he had Desi Sills empty out the left corner.
Mm-hmm.
And so that takes out a help defender, and basically
Joe's able to lay it off
the
glass.
Yeah, able to get it off the glass. That was a terrific play he drew up right there.
Yeah, Joe put it in with 21 seconds left in the game, and then Watford put his layup and one in with 8 seconds. So 8 seconds, that would be where the timeout in moving the ball up in the like they do in the NBA would have helped Arkansas extremely there, because Musselman could have run a play, maybe get Joe coming off of some kind of screen action or anything like that.
I think he likes opposing defenses to have to guard the entire floor though.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And I think he can, just like with Isaiah, he had when he brought the ball up for his and one, he brings the ball up from the baseline and has a little bit of momentum. I think he's got a little bit of speed built up. And I think it catches defenders off guard a little bit when he's kind of coming downhill a little bit. I didn't mind it. I didn't mind that at all.
I just think that with Jones out of the game, that Arkansas needed as little dribbling to happen, because their best playmaker with the ball in his hands is not in the game. And like I said multiple times, Joe's better when he's not off the dribble. He can make shots off the dribble. I mean, he can drive, but obviously the plan here was not for him to drive, or else he should have. It looked like that Joe's defender was baiting him into driving, and I think that Musselman wanted to either win the game or end the game, win the game or lose the game right there at the end by going for the three, which makes sense, but
And I get that with considering Arkansas's depth. I really do. I get it. Just kind of wanting to stick a dagger on them right at the end of regulations, kind of see if you can't go in there and grab a win.
Man, it was a fantastic game though, which Arkansas has had some fantastic games in Baton Rouge. It always seems like, you know, there are the games that are the blowouts, but there's close games, contested games, and, you know, that game last year where Arkansas was able to pull out a victory off of a Mason Jones last-second shot was a classic game that Arkansas, you know, Razorback fans felt like that they didn't get a lot of calls. They powered through, and that was one of LSU's two losses for LSU in the conference play. So that's a fun environment to go play in, and I think that this team will learn a lot from this. And I'm going to go out on a limb here, not really, and say I think that the defensive rebounding and just the rebounding in general will be a lot better against Ole Miss.
There will be a lot of attention to that over the next couple of days. That's what I wrote in my post-game thoughts last night. I really like the fight and the grit in this team because they just kept getting knocked down, whether it was the 26-0 and second chance points, the minus 29 rebounding margin, the 2 second half deficits that got up to 6 and 7 points, and then just answering back on those on Trendon Watford's and ones with other buckets. I mean, this team is just like really, really mentally tough. May not have looked like it for the entire night, but these guys are just tough in general. This team is just really tough, doesn't have any quit in it, and I would be really surprised if this team is not like rearing to go on Saturday at Ole Miss. I think Ole Miss is a great bounce back opportunity for Arkansas.
Yeah, this is a game that Arkansas can win on the road, and I think that, like you said, it's a bounce back opportunity. Before we go, Scotty, here on the Basketball Podcast of Mid-America, give me a key for Arkansas versus Ole Miss.
Brian Tyree somehow is still at Ole Miss, and he's really good. I think Ole Miss scored 47 points the other night at Texas A&M, and Brian Tyree had 26 of them.
Jeez.
So he's a mid 30% 3-point shooter. But he doesn't settle though either. He's taken over 100 2-point looks too. Gets the line fairly well, but he's their offense. He's taken 32.7% of their shots. So he's like their go-to guy on offense. I think you got to prevent a good day from him, and then maybe kind of limit Devontae Shuler, because Shuler can play too. He's shooting 36% from three as well. I think you can't get bullied on the glass again. They've got, or the Rebels have a 6'10 kid, named Kadeem Sy, who's rebounding 8.4% of Ole Miss's missed shots, and he's grabbing almost 20% of available defensive boards when he's on the floor. So I think it's kind of the keys that the keys are what got you beat at LSU. You just got to clean up the glass a little bit more, continue to take care of the ball. I think Arkansas only had like one turnover through the first 15 plus minutes the other night, which that's how you win on the road. You take care of the ball and limit transition opportunities for the team, for the home team. And, you know, if Mason Jones can keep playing well, he's like, we haven't talked about him like over the last five games. He has been absolutely phenomenal. I think he's averaging close to 25 points a game, and he's shooting 44% from three over his last five games since, you know, kind of the stinker against Western Kentucky where he went 1 of 9. He's been great. Jalen's kind of been flying under the radar. I think he's playing well. I'll be curious to see, you know, if Reggie's still not with it, Jalen's role increasing a little bit, especially with Desi kind of struggling from three. Like, he's continued to struggle from three a little bit. And then, you know, I think I've just about covered everything, but Isaiah maybe kind of get back on track. What was he, two of nine?
2 of 9 from 3-point range.
From three. Yeah, so we'll see if he can bounce back a little bit. He had been playing so well leading into that game, like averaging almost 20 points a game. So I think those are the keys. It's just the keys are what got you beat at LSU. You just got to, you know, box out, take care of the ball, and let your players make plays.
Ask for one key and Scotty gives us the entire
book at you.
that's okay. That's why you come here to the Basketball Podcast of Mid-America. The Whole Hog Podcast is produced and edited for Airship by me, Seth Campbell. Special shout-outs to Nick Suss, Tom Murphy, and Scotty Bordelon. You can read more from Nick on the Clarion Ledger website. You can read more from Scotty on wholehogsports.com. If you like this podcast and want to hear more, make sure to subscribe so you won't miss any great Razorback content. Theme music is by Silent Partners. I'm Seth Campbell for Whole Hog Sports. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you back here next week.